Thank you very much. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to speak about this work, which I've done recently in collaboration with Lars Bonnes and Andreas Leuchli, both at Innsbruck. So here's a brief outline of what I hope to cover. So I'll start with a fairly general introduction to quantum quenches. So a lot of that material has already been covered by previous speakers, but I'm just going to run through it again. So if you want to sleep, you can do that during the first 15 minutes or so. I'll tell you when you're supposed to wake up again, all right? Then I start introducing the kind of effects I'm interested in describing. And then finally basically come to the new results, which have to do with how correlations or information spreads after quenches in one-dimensional systems. And I'll give an interpretation of how this information spreads in terms of some kinds of excitations, we call it in quotes. It will become clear why it's in quotes. So there's a nice physical picture that tells you how information spreads. So if you have any questions at any point, just feel free to interrupt me. Okay, so general setting is that of isolated, quantum systems out of equilibrium. So the idea here is we consider quantum many particle system with some Hamiltonian. I want it to be actually translationally invariant. There shouldn't be a randomness. So clean system. And the idea is we prepare the system initially in some density matrix. It's not a pure state in this talk. It's actually a mixed state in general, which does not correspond to an eigenstate. And I will, however, assume that this initial density matrix is nice, in particular that it fulfills things like cluster decomposition property. And as I said before, it should be also translationally invariant. Okay, so once I'm given this density matrix and a Hamiltonian, I can just formally write down the time-evolved density matrix by solving the Heisenberg equation or the Schrödinger equation, if you want. So that will be my density matrix at a later time. And then the general problem is to then use this density matrix and determine the time evolution of local observables. So basically traces of this density matrix of some class of local operators. So local always means local in space. So we'll be talking about spin chains. So that might be spin operators all acting on some given segment of a one-dimensional quantum spin chain. Okay, so as we already have heard in many of the previous talks, the general idea about these isolated systems is that in spite of being isolated, they still can relax in the following sense, so they can relax locally. What that means is we never should think of our system as a whole. We always should think in terms of subdividing our system in a finite subsystem, which I call B, and the rest of the system, which I call A here. And for things to be really clean, A should be very, very large. So in particular, I want A to be thermodynamically large, so infinite. And the idea is, if I now ask questions only about my subsystem B, which is arbitrary, however, completely arbitrary, then expectation values of local operators, so which, let's say, only live in a part of the system, they typically will relax to some stationary values after relatively short times. And the physical picture that underlies all of this, in spite of the fact that the system is isolated, there's no heat bath, the system acts as its own bath. So A, the complement of my subsystem, acts like a bath for B, so probability can escape from B, leak into A, and because A is infinitely large, it will never come back.
So, Fabian, but this is not necessary to have this split, right? So
I think this is the cleanest picture, and this is the picture I'm following here. throughout this talk. And this is a self-consistent, clean way of defining things. It's not the only way. And as we have seen in some of the other talks, there are different tastes. This is one way to formulate things, and it's perfectly equivalent if you understand what you're doing to the other ways of looking at things.
So for example, you would say momentum nk need not relax.
Yes, okay, so a good question. So what about something like a mode occupation number? Mode occupation number lives in Fourier space, so strictly speaking, it's always a question that involves the entire system, okay? On the other hand, now it depends what momentum you're considering. So if you consider, let's say, a large momentum, not necessarily close to zero, you can approximate this mode occupation number to basically an arbitrary precision by looking at a subsystem. Yeah. The real problem you start having is if you're interested in n of zero. So n of zero, I'm not considering here, basically, but with this procedure, if you look at it in the right way, basically the mode occupation for any finite momentum is covered.
Okay? But actually, n of zero could be perfectly where.
Yes, could be perfectly. Yes, it could be, but it's not something I choose to consider here.
Right.
Okay? Right. Now, what is very nice about this way of doing things is it doesn't involve time averaging at all. Yeah, so I work in the thermodynamic limit. So here, these local observables, really, they settle after some transient time evolution. And I never have to average over time. Okay? And as I said, physical picture A acts like a bath for my subsystem. Now, that's a physical picture I've given you, so you can make this a little bit more formal.
So can I ask another question? I'm sorry. So it's not guaranteed that that any local observable that you look, it will relax to something that is time independent in the thermodynamic limit?
Yes, it is. Because let's put it like this. So there's no general proof, yeah? So as in any of these things, yeah? So we're not doing mathematical physics. There's no rigorous proof that any there's no general proof that shows that this picture is correct. However, the picture has been proven for a number of examples. So for example, for the quantum easing chain, so that was the work I did with Calabresi and Fagotti, it is true for any local observable because it's a proof at the level of the reduced density matrix of an arbitrary subsystem. Right. So yes, indeed, you're guaranteed. So now this picture is believed to hold more generally, yeah. But once again, there's no proof.
Right, but I can put you an example of something that is locally will never relax and is a non-trivial integrable system. So take the Calover of Sutherland in the trap.
Yeah, but just a moment.
The center of the trap, which is density, it will oscillate forever.
Just a moment. So there, okay. So with regards to the relaxation, of course there is an additional requirement on the initial density matrix. Okay, if the initial density matrix is, let's say, a superposition of two Hamiltonian eigenstates, of course it won't work. Yeah, so you can always construct atypical counterexamples. Yeah, but so this is really the generic case. If you start in some non-specially chosen initial density matrix, this is what will happen. Okay, now to formalize this physical picture a little bit, what we want to do is we want to consider the reduced density matrix of my subsystem, which once again is arbitrary. So all I do is I take my density matrix of the entire system, yeah, which I'm basically given at least formally. Then I trace out the complement of my subsystem, gives me the reduced density matrix of subsystem B. And the information content, so this comes back to one of the questions Marcos just asked, so what's the information content of this reduced density matrix? It actually contains complete information about all local correlation functions which live in my subsystem. So that's very easy to see. So here I consider just an example of a spin-half quantum spin chain. Take as my subsystem a segment of my chain. Okay, so then this by construction is an operator that lives only on my segment, which means and I'm dealing with therefore with a finite dimensional linear vector space, so I can expand it in terms of a basis of vectors, and the basis of vectors are just these products of Pauli matrices. Okay, and then you can convince yourself very easily the coefficients of this expansion, they actually have to be, by construction, the expectation values with respect to your density matrix of these local operators. So if you know this reduced density matrix, you know everything, any question you could possibly ask about your subsystem. So it's. Now, we can use this to define what we mean by a stationary state. So if the infinite time limit of this reduced density matrix exists for any finite subsystem, where I first have taken the thermodynamic limit, so the complement of the subsystem is infinitely large, then we say the system approaches a stationary state, and what it means essentially that the averages of any local operator becomes time independent. That's how I would define relaxation to a stationary state.
By average, you mean quantum expectation value?
Quantum expectation value, yeah. With respect to the density matrix that underlies all of this. Okay? Now, obvious question is, well, what physical properties actually determine this ensemble? Yeah. So now I want to describe essentially the expectation values in the stationary state through some statistical ensemble. And the question is, what is the organizing principle? And we have already heard about this quite a lot. So there are essentially two scenarios of relevance. One is thermalization, and the belief is most systems or generic systems, they thermalize in the sense I have just defined. More precisely, let's define a Gibbs ensemble for our entire system. Yeah, so I define it by just specifying the density matrix of a Gibbs ensemble. H is my Hamiltonian of the entire system. The temperature is fixed by requiring, this formula is not quite right, the energy density, so I should divide this by volume, of the Hamiltonian in the Gibbs ensemble should be equal to the energy density in my initial density matrix. Yeah, so it just means energy is conserved, so the energy density I have initially in my system must be the same I have in the stationary state. That fixes beta, so no free parameter. So that's my Gibbs ensemble. Now I trace out the complement of my subsystem, so I get this reduced density matrix. That is not of Gibbs form. You can write it in this way, but your Hamiltonian will be some mess, obviously, because you have traced out the complement. And then the definition of thermalization in this language simply would be, if for any finite subsystem, the reduced density matrix after the quench is at infinite times is equal to the reduced density matrix of this Gibbs ensemble, then the system thermalizes. And so, yeah, so these ideas go back a few years now in the quench context. And for example, Jens was one of the people who pushed this point of view. Physical picture simply is, well, A acts like a heat bath with some effective temperature on your subsystem. Okay. Now, the second paradigm, let's say, of a statistical ensemble that emerges in many of these quench problems that have been analyzed is this generalized Gibbs ensemble. And that was proposed by Marcos and collaborators a few years ago. And that is believed to apply quite generally to non-equilibrium evolution in integrable systems. So systems which have a macroscopic number, let's say, of integrals of motion, which are local in space. That's the definition of an integrable system. Okay, now the way I like to define it, because it's for generic integrable systems, actually the only way you can do it, is you focus on these local integrals of motion. Local basically means the following. So your integral of motion IN or something like this, you can write this as a sum over your spatial coordinates. And then here you have a density of this charge, and this density would live, in the simplest case, for example, only on n consecutive sites, let's say, for the nth conservation law. Yeah, so those would be the simplest type of conservation, local conservation laws. So the density of the conservation law is very local in space. And that's a characteristic property of integrable models. Okay, now these, so many of these we know how to construct for integrable models, like the Heisenberg model or Hubbard model, whatever you like. And having these in hand, you can now define a density matrix by just generalizing the Gibbs ensemble by putting all these local conservation laws in the exponent here. So the simplest example would simply be a grand canonical ensemble. Yeah? If you have particle number conserved and energy conserved, that would be grand canonical. But here you have all these other conservation laws, you also put them in the exponent here. And once again, these Lagrange multipliers, lambda m, they are not free parameters, they're all fixed. And here I have correctly put the 1 over L. They are fixed by the requirements that these charges are actually conserved. So their expectation value in the initial density matrix has to be the same as their expectation value in the stationary, in the statistical ensemble, which is supposed to describe the infinite time limit. Okay, now what we go through the same steps as before for the thermal case. So we form this reduced density matrix of a subsystem B by tracing out the environment. And then we say the system is described by a generalized Gibbs ensemble if for any finite subsystem B, the infinite time limit of the reduced density matrix after the quench is given by the reduced density matrix of this ensemble. Yes?
And is that also lambda n, where n is larger than the subsystem B? But then
say again?
So you also include lambda n where the n is larger than the subsystem
yes.
B?
Yeah, okay, good question. I mean, so how many of these conserved charges do I include? So I'm really working, typically I'm interested in the thermodynamic limit. So there's an infinite number, yeah? And I consider a finite subsystem in a thermodynamic limit, so I include many, many conservation laws where the density, yeah, so these guys are much, much larger than my subsystem, okay? So they're included here. But what we have shown for a special case with Maurizio Fagotti is the ones that matter, yeah, for the expectation value of local observables are the ones where the densities here basically fit into your subsystem, roughly speaking. Yeah? So the more local, the more important these are to describe the stationary behavior. So that's a physical picture. Okay? But even the ones which have densities that span, I don't know, a million sites, in principle, if I consider a subsystem of two sites, they would be included here.
But they will not constrain them.
Sorry?
They will not constrain.
That's what I just told you, or try to tell you. Indeed, you're right. Yeah. But to prove this is a different matter. So what I said, we were able to show this for a particular case. Yeah. But there's no general proof of this. But I believe what you're saying is exactly true, but yeah. Okay, good. So now, okay, so this is, the physical picture is, once again, A acts like a bath for B, but it's not a standard heat bath because infinite information about the initial conditions is retained through the precise values of all of these Lagrange multipliers. So it's kind of a strange bath. Good, so now you should wake up. I mean, so all of this was kind of very general, and the other speakers have already covered this from different angles. So this basically was just a rephrasing in the language I like. Now, for what I'm going to say later, I will need a microcanonical version of these statistical distributions. And this probably was, as far as I know, was first, once again, proposed for a particular example by Marcos of particle bosons, and a very general construction for integral models is due to JS and myself last year. So the general idea basically is if you have this generalized Gibbs density matrix, in the thermodynamic limit, it's actually dominated in the simplest case just by a single saddle point. Okay, and the saddle point state, one can construct, so we gave a method of constructing it. And having this saddle point state in hand, you can now form a density matrix, yeah, which is a one-dimensional projector on this state, which we call representative state. And this ensemble is locally indistinguishable from this generalized Gibbs ensemble. So if I just interested in expectation value of local observables, I can't tell the difference between this one and this one. Okay, so an important property of this saddle point state, it's actually a simultaneous eigenstate of all local conservation laws. Okay? And that's once again is clear because the expectation value of all these local conservation laws, it was fixed initially. It has to be same, it has to be the same in my statistical ensemble. Okay, so now my representative state is an eigenstate, so it has to be an eigenstate with the right eigenvalue for all these conserved charges such that I correctly reproduce their conserved values. Okay? Good. Right. Now, so that was now framework. So now the question I actually want to address is so-called horizon or light cone effects after quenches. And a nice way of approaching this subject, I think, is to go back to some papers by Pasquale Calabresi and John Cardi, almost 10 years old now, and they considered certain quenches, yeah, from initial states, pure states actually in their case, with finite correlation length to conformal field theories in 1+1 dimensions. And what they found is the following. So they looked, for example, at a connected two-point function of some local operator, and they found that this connected two-point function in the CFT limit actually vanished for some initial time period, which was related to the separation, spatial separation of these two operators. And the speed of light here was set equal to 1. And then, so initially, these correlations, connected correlations, are absent. And then at some specific time, they start taking off. Right? So there's a clear horizon effect in these connected correlators, which occurs at a time which is related to the separation between the two operators by r is equal to vt. Now, the factor of 2 at first sight is quite worrying, yeah, because the most naive expectation might be, well, it should take off at a time that is just related to the separation by r equals vt. But Pasquale and John actually already put forward an explanation of this in terms of what they called a quasi-particle picture. And quasi-particle picture is the following idea. So at time t equal to 0, this is when you quench your system. So you really shake it up. And what you do is throughout the entire system, you locally create entangled quasi-particle pairs. Yeah. And let's just say, and they were thinking about conformal field theories, that you have certain elementary excitations which are very long-lived or infinitely long-lived, actually, in their case. So that's what they meant by quasi-particles. Okay, so you create these entangled pairs, and then they start propagating in time with, in their case, it's a relativistic quantum field theory with the speed of light. Okay, and If I now measure a connected correlation function here at time t, yeah, of two operators at a separation r, yeah, they start being correlated. The connected correlation is starting to be non-zero exactly when 2vt is the separation, yeah, because the pair of quasi-particles starts here. One moves to the left, one moves to the right. So that's where the factor of 2 comes from. Yeah.
The point is, you can have completely classical explanations does it mean that entangled pairs, don't they entangled not really quantum in this context?
So
consider classical Lagrange liquid and you have exactly the same explanation.
The Lagrange liquid is a particular case of a conformal field theory. Okay, look, I mean, I think this picture, I'll come back to this. This is actually what I want to talk about. Yeah. And I think it's a full quantum effect. Okay? Now, the first comment is this turns out to be extremely general and is seen in particular in many non-relativistic cases as long as your Hamiltonians are short-range. If your Hamiltonian is not short-range, so if you have long-range interactions, the story is quite different. And if you're interested in that, ask, for example, Jens, who wrote a paper about this last year. But so other examples are, so if you consider, for example, a transitive Ising chain, so this Hamiltonian, and you consider a quench by preparing the system in the ground state for a small value of this transverse field, and then at time t equal to zero, quench your transverse field to another small value, so you stay in the same phase, and you measure, as a function of time, the connected correlation function of the order parameter at a given distance, which I have taken to be 20 here. Then you see the connected correlation function initially is very, very small, and then at some time, which actually turns out to be L divided by 2 times the maximal velocity in this case, then it starts taking off. It's exactly the same effect, but now it's a non-relativistic lattice model. So then, even long before, this was observed by considering quenches in the in model of spinless fermions by Salvatore Manmana and collaborators. So they essentially quenched the density-density interaction of this one-dimensional spinless fermion system. And then they looked at connected density-density correlations. And so here, a number of quenches from some strong value of V initially to some finite value of V. And so same picture as before. So here would be a time coordinate. So this would be the separation between your two density operators. And if you now fix the separation between your two densities, you see initially this connected correlation is just zero. And then at some finite time, it starts taking off. Okay, so it's once again the same horizon effect.
The light cone effects change at all? Quasi-particles are non-local with respect to the observable.
Just ask again if I haven't answered this in about 10 minutes or so. All right? Yeah. I mean, basically, what I want to talk about is I'm trying to explain this light cone effect. So I will have to answer your question. Now, this has been seen not only in numerical experiments, it actually has also been seen in cold atom experiments. A few years ago, there was a paper by Chenot and collaborators, and essentially they looked at a optical lattice, and I think it was rubidium atoms, and they quenched the ratio between the interactions to the kinetic energy, by basically ramping up this optical potential or ramping it down. And what they measured is a slightly strange looking connected correlation functions. It's not exactly a density-density correlation function because they can't tell experimentally the difference between having essentially two bosons or zero bosons at the same place. So what it is, it's a two-point function of this operator, which they call an occupation parity. So Nj would be the occupation at psi j of time at time t, and n bar would be the mean occupation number. Okay, but once again, it's a particular type of connected two-point function, and this is the experimental data. So this is the time for them. Okay, and the different curves here correspond to different separations between these two sites where they do their measurement. And they see the same thing. they see essentially that for a given separation, let's say, the correlation is zero until eventually it starts taking off. So they see essentially something like a light cone. All right. Now, the first question one should ask, well, why does this actually happen? This is pretty weird because there's no speed limit in non-relativistic quantum theory. There's no speed of light. There's nothing. So why should this happen? So why don't you have connected correlation straight away after doing your quench? And that one can understand by referring back to these Leib-Robinson bounds we have heard about a little bit yesterday. And that goes back to some considerations of non-equal time correlations in quantum spin chains in the 70s. And what was considered there is essentially non-relativistic quantum spin systems, so let's say a quantum spin chain, if you wish. Then this Leib-Robinson theorem, essentially what it proved is if you look at operators defined in two subsystems, A and B, which are separated by a distance L, then the commutator of OA at time t and OB at time zero, so the operator norm of that quantity is bounded. Okay? And that basically means that there's some notion of causality, yeah, because this is related to a response function, and basically this tells you that the response function has to be small for a very long period of time. Now, from this, it was then shown in 2006 by Bravi, Hastings, and Verstrate that in the quench context, this implies that connected equal time correlation functions for operators separated by some distance L. So this equal time connected correlation function is less than this bound here. And importantly, this bound includes here the separation between the two subsystems. And if this separation is large, the right-hand side actually is exponentially small at short times, which basically tells you that these connected correlation functions, they're not zero initially after the quench, but they're very, very small. They're exponentially small until some finite time, which is not known, when this bound basically doesn't tell you anything useful anymore because the right-hand side becomes large.
But what about time equals to zero? You can't have power of correlation.
Yes, 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 yes. But wait. I'm considering here thermal initial state, so I have a finite correlation length in all cases, and I'm using that here.
It's specific for 1D systems and finite
density. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, for my purposes. I always want my initial density matrix to have a finite correlation length. Yeah. So that's important. I'm not saying anything about interaction quenches in Langer liquid or something like this. Yeah. So there, the story is much less nice, so I don't want to talk about it. Okay, what this tells you is there's some kind of speed limit for sizable connected correlations to emerge, quite generally. Okay, so now let's try to become a little bit more specific. The question I want to ask now, having shown you there's a lot of evidence in the literature that there are these light cone effects, yeah. What actually is the propagation velocity of the light cone? So what determines it? Yeah, because this Leib-Robinson bound gives you a bound. There's some velocity in there, but it's completely unclear what this V is. Yeah? And I told you before, for free bosons or free fermions or even for the Ising model, we know what this propagation velocity is, but these are kind of special cases, and the general case actually is different. Now, okay, just to say this again, so for free theories, you can convince yourself relatively easily, I come back to that in a couple of slides, that this propagation velocity of the light cone is just the maximal group velocity of excitations in the system. And because it's a free theory, the notion of excitation is an absolute notion. Yeah? So it's essentially independent of your state that you're considering. So free theories are kind of very, very special, and this is maybe not so interesting. Okay, but so I want to talk about interacting theories where there are story is much more interesting, and there are new effects.
But you want to be on a lattice.
I'm always on a lattice. Yeah. But okay, specific example we have looked at are quantum quenches in the spinor half XXZ chain. So it's this Hamiltonian here. And then the initial density matrix we have considered is just a Gibbs ensemble. Yeah, at some temperature, initial temperature, whatever, we have considered a whole variety of temperatures. Zero temperature can be zero temperature, can be high temperature, can be low temperature, it doesn't matter. And some particular initial value of the anisotropy parameter delta here. So what we do is initially we prepare the system at a finite temperature for some interaction strength. Then we quench the interaction strength, and then we let the system go. The observable we have studied is just the connected spin-spin correlation function of spin in z direction. Yeah, and as z is a because you have rotational symmetry on the z-axis, so total sz is conserved, right? So that's the good direction, if you wish. Now, I'm going to show you some numerical data now. The numerical data was obtained essentially by considering a finite system size, fixing one of these spin operators in the middle of the chain and the other one at some distance j from it. And this correlation function was computed numerically using some method which is called METS, so minimally entangled typical thermal states, so some particular matrix product method. And the results are shown here. So this is for initial interaction strength 4 to some particular value which is between 0 and 1. Okay? And this is very similar to the pictures I've already shown you. So this would be a time axis. So this would be the spatial separation. This is for two different initial density matrix. So here we initially prepare it in the ground state of delta equals 4. And here we prepare it in the Gibbs ensemble at beta j equal to 1. But roughly speaking, it looks very similar. So there's a light cone effect. So if I fix the separation, so initially this connected correlation is really, really small, and then it starts taking off. So there's a nice light cone effect. So, all right. The only new thing, in a sense, that you can take away from this straight away, so even if you have a thermal initial density matrix, still there is a nice light cone effect. Okay. But now the things become more interesting. So if you look more closely, if you take this data and analyze it more closely, you actually see that the propagation velocity of this light cone depends not only on the final Hamiltonian, but also on the initial density matrix. And this is a very busy slide here. Okay, so what is done there is the data for the light cones on the previous slide is replotted. Yeah, so dashed was for this ground state quench, and the solid line is for the finite temperature quench. And the different colors here correspond to different spatial separations between the points where you make your measurement. Yeah.
I have a question on previous slides. It looks like light velocities takes over very fast. I just wonder, can you access it within like short time perturbations in here?
No. I mean, short time perturbation theory, basically, no. Yeah. Where was I? Yeah. So you should compare the dashed and the solid. And if you look, you basically see that the dashed precedes the solid. Okay. So basically, the light cone propagation velocity for the ground state quench is larger than the propagation velocity for the finite temperature quench. Okay, so that's already quite interesting. So not only the final Hamiltonian is important, also the initial state. Now, once you realize that this is true, then the next question is, well, which of the properties of the initial state actually are important for this light cone propagation velocity? And then, now, just an observation based on these numerical studies is there's a rather good, within the arrow bars, data collapse if you plot the velocity as a function of the final state energy. So just the expectation value of the final Hamiltonian, which makes your time evolution, in your initial density matrix. Yeah. So if you plot here this final state energy, and here the light cone propagation velocity for many different quenches. So the red ones are always to a final state Hamiltonian where delta is cosine pi over 4, and the black ones for quenches where the final delta is a half. You see the data basically collapse along these two lines. Yeah. So within the arrow bars. So what we can tell on the basis of the numerical results, how fast the light cone emerges depends on how much energy you have pumped into the system. Yeah? And beyond that, we don't really know as far as the numerics is concerned. Okay, but now how to understand this fact? Okay, now, okay, so one more thing about the GGE. So now this XXZ chain is integrable. And therefore, according to what I've told you earlier, the stationary state should be described by some appropriate generalized Gibbs ensemble. Yeah? Unfortunately, this GGE is quite complicated because the structure of the conservation laws, which are known for the XXZ chain, is quite involved. So there are essentially two classes of local conservation laws, which are called, one is called ultra-local. They are of the form I have described for you earlier. So the density just lives in a strictly finite interval of your chain. That's why they're called ultra-local, and they have been known for a very long time. Yeah, and we basically know how to handle them. But then a couple of years ago or so, Prosen and Ilyevsky, they discovered there is a second class of local conservation laws. They are more complicated, yeah, because they're these densities, yeah, so they don't live only on a strictly finite subinterval, yeah. So they have tails, yeah, but these tails are exponentially small. Okay, so basically, what you would have there, you would have these sigma z's basically throughout your chain, but the amplitude of this very non-local term would be exponentially small in the range. So these are local. If you would go to some continuum limit, this would just translate into some higher derivative, yeah, higher spatial derivative. So they're local. Unfortunately, these are really nasty. Yeah, and that's why the construction of the GGE for this case remains an open problem. Okay. Now, just keep this in mind. Now, in order to analyze this light cone effect, what I want to do is I want to use some formalism we introduced with JS last year. So what we argued quite generally is that time evolution of observables after a quench to an integrable model prepared in some initial state, which for our case was a pure state, is given by this formula here. Yeah. So in the thermodynamic limit, the time evolution is given essentially by this matrix element. So this is my operator at time t. Here is this representative state I've told you before. Yeah. So this saddle point state of my generalized Gibbs ensemble, and psi is my initial state. Okay. So this is quite a simplification, yeah, compared to what you had before, because this phi s actually is an eigenstate of the time evolution operator. So this is very, very easy to handle. And in particular, if you write a Lehmann representation of this, it involves only a single sum over a complete set of states rather than a double sum, which you would get just by a brute force expansion of the definition of this quantity. Now, this representative state, as I've told you before, it's a simultaneous eigenstate of the local conservation law such that they have the right values. And we gave a description how to construct this state phi s in principle by using some generalized thermodynamic Betian satz. This construction so far has been achieved only in simple cases. So in our paper, so we did it for easing. Now JS's group in the last couple of years has managed to do this for particular initial density matrices for Lieb-Leninger and XXZ, but certainly not for the very complicated density matrix I need to handle here. And we have done it for a simple density matrix in Sein-Gordon. Okay, now let's assume for the time being that we know what this representative state is for the quenches we have considered, for these quenches from initially thermal density matrices. Now the main idea comes here. So the main idea is that the light cone velocity is determined simply by excitations over the representative state. Yeah? So it's a very simple picture. You can motivate this by going to a Lehmann representation of this quantity here. So what we say is basically the time evolution of, of any observable, any local observable, and this connected correlation function is a particular example thereof, is given by this quantity here. And so now what I do is I write a Lehmann representation of this quantity and in terms of energy eigenstates, and it looks like this. Yeah? Now, the important states on the right-hand side will simply be the ones where the energy difference here between the representative state and the other states in the spectral sum will be order one. That's kind of clear, because otherwise you have an extremely rapidly oscillating factor here, and then if you do the sum over your states, it just would average out. Okay? And this physical picture therefore means our representative state is some eigenstate of the final state Hamiltonian, which somewhere lies in the middle of the spectrum. It's an eigenstate, but it's an eigenstate at finite energy density. So it sits somewhere here. And now what we want to do is we want to construct the excitation spectrum relative to this state. So we want to, in order to pick out the time dependence here.
Why is it order one and not order inverse t? Because the t times the energy difference within the electron.
Yeah, okay. So what all I need is that it's not order L. That's all I need. Okay? As long as it's not order the system size, I'm okay. Yeah?
I'm just a little confused about why does this representative state come up in the first place? Because I thought that something came up after you time evolved to infinity.
Yes, indeed. But okay, very good question. I mean, so I introduced it by basically saying it's a characteristic of the stationary state. But what we showed with JS in this paper is that it even basically defines the time evolution. Yeah. Okay. So its significance by far transcends just the stationary state. Yeah. So it basically, in principle, allows you to describe the entire time evolution. And the nice thing about this representation here, it's actually, if you write it out in a Lehmann representation, this starts looking very similar to the type of thing you get for the Lehmann representation of response functions in equilibrium. Yeah. So this stationary state comes from the saddle point. This representative state comes from the saddle point in the stationary state, but it does describe the time evolution. Well, I mean, so she was first.
Just my question. So then, if it was non-integrable, would the representative state just be any state in the microcanonical?
Yes, I mean that would be my best guess, indeed. Yeah. So in principle, one can think about this formalism even for. System that's thermalized, and that's what I would guess.
Yeah. I had a very similar question. So this doesn't require integrability with the statement.
No. Well, just a moment. So we believe not. Yeah. But in order to construct this state, we used integrability. So I have 5 minutes, but that should be just about enough. So now let me come back to free theories. So think of a Fermi gas. So how do I construct excitations around a state in the middle of the spectrum? So for free theories, all of you know this. So Hamiltonian I can write in the occupation number representation simply in this form. It's diagonal. And for free theories, it's very easy to construct a GGE. These local conservation laws are linear related actually just to the mode occupation numbers. And a very common way of defining the GGE actually for free theories is in terms of these mode occupation numbers, n of k. And it just takes this form here. So you basically have a different temperature for every oscillator mode. OK, so now our representative state is some state which has particular values of all of these mode occupation numbers. OK, by definition, because the mode occupation numbers are the conserved charges. And I told you I fixed them in the initial state. And that tells me what this representative state is. OK, so for the free theory, then I can simply define essentially particle and hole densities. Yeah, in terms of these mode occupation numbers, it's given here, all right? And that describes my representative state. It's completely general for free theories, and I can now very easily construct excitations by, I have these distributions of particles and holes, and I can move, let's say, a particle from here and move it there. Yeah, and the energy that this costs is just given in terms of these single particle energies here. Okay, that tells you immediately that the propagation velocity of the light cone has to be the maximal group velocity of these free particles. Now, okay, so I know I'm going to start a bit late, though, but all right. So now for XXE, it's a little bit more complicated because the nature of these elementary excitations is much more complicated. So there, in general, so we have a large number of different species of elementary excitations. The number of these elementary excitations actually depends on the value of the interaction. And so, for example, if you look at excitations over the ground state, there's only one type of excitation. But if you now think of more general states, you will have many, many different species of excitations. And the precise characterization of these excitations actually depends on where in the spectrum you're looking, so to speak. So now, using methods of integrability, what you can do is you can describe this representative state where all the action is in terms of particle hole densities of these infinitely long-lived elementary excitations, which have nothing to do with free fermions or even the spinons in general. And moreover, the particle and hole densities are no longer related in a trivial way as they were for free particles. So now they are related in a very non-trivial way. But we have a way of working these out. Now what we can do is we can work out how much energy it costs to slightly make slight changes to these distributions of particles and holes by basically poking an extra hole, putting an extra particle in one of these different species of excitation. That will give me some energies which are now functionals of these root densities describing the stationary state. So the excitations, the nature of the excitation actually depends on my representative state, so it depends on precisely where I'm looking. And then the light cone propagation velocity is simply the maximum group velocity of all of these elementary excitations. Now, importantly, I've stressed this already, these energies here, they depend on the representative state in a non-trivial way and depend on the interactions in a non-trivial way. So there's some dressing. OK, so the upshot of all of this discussion is that we believe that the light cone propagation velocity is determined, in fact, by the expectation values of all conservation laws in the initial density matrix, not just energy density, but of all of these higher conservation laws too. And so technically, now we have to calculate these velocities. I'm not going to show you how this is done. If you're interested, you can ask me later. So we have a way with some simplifying assumptions to calculate these maximal velocities. And the comparison now to the numerical results is shown here. For example, for quenches from some initial value of 4 to this particular value of the final interaction, And this different line, the different data sets here correspond to different temperatures in this initial density matrix. And basically, what we find is for all cases we have looked at, the velocities we get out of this procedure, they are perfectly consistent with the numerical results. So this indeed is a consistent picture. And the complete collection of all the data is basically shown here. So this black line here is what comes out of the calculation I have just sketched. And so here, similarly, these red lines, they come out of these calculations I've shown. And once again, we get a consistent picture. Okay, so then this brings me to my summary, so I'm not running too much late. The one thing you hopefully will take away from it, that these light cone effects after quantum quenches are much more interesting than one perhaps anticipated. They're related to properties of quote-unquote excitations around particular Hamiltonian eigenstates which are high up in the spectrum. And integrability allows actually a full description of such excitations, and if you do that, it seems to work out rather well. Now, what would be nice is to basically refine some of the technical details of our calculation. So this is a work in progress. One question you might ask, I told you there are all these different species of elementary excitations, yeah? And what the light cone is related to is it's related to the maximal group velocity of the fastest species. Yeah? What about all these other species? Are there signatures of those, perhaps, also in these connected correlation functions? So can there be multiple light cones, let's say? And indeed, this seems to be the case. And finally, you might ask, well, what if you quench your non-integrable models? Yeah, so then these excitations will be quite different because they're not infinitely long-lived, so they're lifetime effects. And indeed, this is something you can see numerically. So thank you for your attention.
Then these models where you don't have a Lie-Brown velocity, but you have exponentially accelerating excitation in principle. How does that fit into your picture of the speed being fixed?
Okay, I don't know. And he will be happy with that answer because it's short.
Okay, so let's think about it again.